Kat Warren is a professor and a former journalist with a somewhat unorthodox hobby. She works with cadaver dogs, dogs who search for missing and presumed dead people. She's joining us now. She has written about her journey and the amazing abilities of working dogs in her book, What the Dog Knows. Kat Warren, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Steve. It's really a pleasure.
So how did you get started with what I guess can be called a hobby? It seems more serious than a hobby, but how did you get started with searching for missing people?
Well, you know, you're right about the it's become more of an avocation, I think. Although I did at first call it a serious hobby, it started with a pup that my husband and I got, a German Shepherd pup, who my expectation of him was he was going to lie under my desk and sleep until I wanted to play with him. And then, you know, we'd go and play in the yard and he'd come back and sleep. And what I got instead was an impossible pup who was also dog aggressive because he'd been a singleton, the only pup in his litter. And it's an odd thing, but that early litter interaction teaches pups how to deal with other dogs as adults. All that, you know, licking and biting and squealing is central to their learning how to send and receive good signals so that they don't constantly get into fights with other dogs as adults. And Solo didn't have that, and he came to us as a little mess. not the fault of the breeder by any means, and I took him to a trainer when he was about 4.5 months old because he'd flunked out of puppy classes, and I'd changed vets. I was at my wit's end. And it was she who suggested this work, which is called having a cadaver dog. And she never thought I would actually stick to it. But I did, and I fell in love with the work. And, of course, that made me fall in love with Solo and learning how to work with him. And he had a fine nose. And, you know, for 8 years, he and I went out on occasion when we were requested by law enforcement to search for people who are missing.
What was it about Solo's, I guess you would say, socialization issues that made him particularly a good candidate for the training to sniff out cadavers? Was there something about just his energy and his need to go out and, you know, burn up all that dog energy ranging across a huge amount of space? What was it that acquitted him to that kind of training, whereas other training not so much working for him?
Well, you know, it was simply an issue of I needed to find something for him to do that didn't necessarily involve him directly interacting with other dogs. And if you think about it, a lot of the work we do with dogs when we're doing sports is, you know, like the obedience ring or agility or these kinds of sports where dogs are working in very close proximity to one another. And that was not going to work for him. And I think that inevitably, once he was really into the work, the dog aggression thing didn't melt away. But if he was working, he would actually ignore other dogs. In other words, it gave him sort of a purpose that helped, you know, help to keep other dogs out of his peripheral vision. And so I think that in retrospect, this is what we always think, is that I was enormously lucky to have a dog with a problem like this because I never would have fallen into this work and been exposed to this entirely new world of law enforcement dogs and that kind of training. And you know, it's been an education.
We're talking with Kat Warren. She's the author of What the Dog Knows. And her dog, Solo, she has taken out many times looking for missing people and ending up finding dead bodies quite often. That's what cadaver dogs do, looking for someone they presume is dead and trying to find the remains. So, Kat, anyone who has taken their dog out for a walk around the block knows that dogs just love to smell things. They want to smell everything. So how do you train a dog like Solo to look for one thing to instead of trying to find some discarded sandwich wrapper or a million other things that dogs seem to want to investigate?
You know, you could actually train a dog to find only discarded sandwich wrappers. That would be pretty easy. I say that lightly, but what's fascinating about dogs' noses is that if you can isolate a scent and then reward them for finding just that scent, then you have any particular scent detection dog. So for Solo, he could have, you know, if I were in law enforcement and invested in the drug wars, he could have easily become a drug dog where he would have found the scent of narcotics, right? With the scent of human remains, it's a really complicated scent. It's a lot like live human scent, only it's generic. People think about live human scent and think about the tracking dog that gets the sock from the missing child and then the dog runs down the path to find the child, right? With human remains, you're actually having a dog ranging back and forth like a hunting dog until it hits the edge of this particular scent and then, in principle, shows you exactly where that person is, you know, often in thick underbrush or even in times, sadly, you know, buried in a clandestine grave. But what it is early on, you teach the dog that that's the scent that they're going to get their reward for, and you essentially reward them with the thing they want the most. For Solo, he wanted a game of tug. He loved to play tug with me, and so I reserved a particular tug toy for when he was doing searches and training. And when he worked hard and found the thing correctly, then he would get a rousing game of tug. So he grew to associate that smell not with death, right, but with his favorite game.
So is there something that a dog knows that is different about the smell of human decomposition versus, say, a dead squirrel or something that I would imagine you could find in a lot of these places that you've been searching? Is there something that specific about the scent of that dead people smell different than something else?
They do, and they do smell different, and forensic chemists are still trying to narrow down exactly what that difference is, and which is fascinating. It's sort of like, well, the dog's nose already knows it, right? And what we do when you're doing what we call laying a foundation on the dog, you actually train them to alert on human remains but not on dead animal remains. And so if they show any interest in, say, a deer skull, you simply ignore them, right? They'll kind of sniff at it and kind of look at you, and you just keep walking past, and the dog goes, oh, not that thing. And then you get to a human bone, and the dog sniffs it and looks at you, and you reward them. You say, that's the thing I want you to look for. And what's interesting is that we've got a few things that people think may make humans different, but they are so vague. One of them is all the chemicals we ingest during our lifetime, right? So even stuff like aerosols, but nobody's narrowed it down for a certainty, and we don't know for certain if that's what interests the dog, right? So we know that chemically there are these differences, but we don't know if those are the specific differences that dogs find interesting.
We don't know, but the dogs still do, and that's why they're so effective. It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. If you're just joining us this hour, we're talking with Kat Warren. She's a professor, a former journalist, and she has a somewhat unorthodox hobby. She works with cadaver dogs, dogs who search for missing and presumed dead people. She did this for 8 years with her dog Solo throughout North Carolina, ranging across the woods and other places looking for these bodies. She's been talking about that with us and her new book. It's called What the Dog Knows. So we've all seen these old movies where there's a convict on the loose and they call out the bloodhounds and they have a rag and they put it up to the dog's nose and then the dog chases down these people. When you first started with this work, this cadaver dog work, did you have any conceptions about what the dogs could and couldn't do with tracking that were kind of busted for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's nice about being a reporter is even if you have your prejudices, you try to go into these things with an open mind and an inquiring mind. And as much as anything, I was getting all the different figures and mixed messages about the dog's nose being either infallible or a million times better than any other nose out there, or, you know, and we often hear this, that the very best nose is the bloodhound's nose, right? And all of these things are a bit of a myth. We actually don't know, right? And saying that dogs' noses are 10 or 100 or 1,000 or a million times better than human noses, we're just making it up. So I think that what happens is that there are people who can go in and take advantage of it, right? In the case of the prison bloodhound, and really that was one of the early uses for bloodhounds, was for tracking convicts out of prisons. And they don't look very much like today's sort of AKC bloodhounds. These were much leaner, rangier dogs. They looked more like big coon hounds than they do what we have today with the really incredible wrinkles and jowls. Is that, you know, these dogs were sent out when somebody escaped. They were sent out pretty fast after that person escaped. And a dog can run a hot trail like that really easily. But what I was hearing is that people were making claims that their dogs could run a trail months sometimes after somebody went missing, or could follow a car down a highway, right?
And yeah, I think that would be kind of hard.
What we've learned is that these are just, yeah, but, you know, tracking the car down the highway, exactly. And yet people kind of want to believe that the dog's noses is such an amazing instrument that they forget that there's a human behind that dog and that humans can be pretty fallible in some of the judgments they make about what their dogs can do. And so part of the joy of researching this book was really talking to the best handlers and trainers out there and the best scientists, and, you know, who said, you know what, there's no evidence for some of these claims, number one. And number two, really, like, the very best handler is saying, boy, if my dog works a four-day-old trail, I'm in heaven. That's a really hard trail. And so if you think about it, these other claims would be just like big fish tails, right? The one that got away, except that some of these cases end up in court, right?
Right.
And in that case, innocent people can go to jail because somebody exaggerates what their dog can do.
Right. And the dog is sending out certain signals. It's all about how the trainer interprets it. So what you're saying is you can have misinterpreted signals or maybe a problem of confirmation bias. The trainer wants the dog right. to find something. And right. so the dog finds something maybe not what you were actually looking for.
Right. And, you know, we've had both cases, right? So there are some pretty infamous cases where we've had handlers that were possibly, on the good side, simply self-delusional or delusional about how good their dogs were. And on the other side, we've had people who are dishonest, right? Corrupt. And we get this in every field imaginable. It's not that everybody should be shocked that in a particular field, you know, we have corrupt doctors, we have corrupt lawyers, we have corrupt architects. So, you know, saying that there's a corrupt handler out there here and there shouldn't be a shock and a surprise. But I think oddly, because they get linked with the dog and we think that the dog is such a kind of an object of perfection, we go, oh my God, this is outrageous, right?
Right.
We really want to believe dogs.
We somehow think that dogs have a degree of nobility in what they're trying to do, but dogs can be trained to do all sorts of things.
We don't have to go back too far in our history to Bull Connor days, you know, when dogs were used to suppress peaceful demonstrations in the South. And I think that we all remember the horrific pictures that came out of Abu Ghraib, the prison in Iraq, where military people were using these dogs to absolutely terrify and essentially torture Iraqis who were in prison, right? So it's that notion that the dog is not capable of making a moral distinction between doing one thing or another. It's not up to the dog. It's really up to people, because dogs are so often willing to just go along for the ride, right?
We're talking with Kat Warren. She is the author of What the Dog Knows. She works with cadaver dogs who search for missing and presumed dead people. Well, one thing in your hobby, your avocation to a degree, finding these cadavers, when you find the body, there's no moral judgment necessarily on how the body got there. It's just finding the body. And the ability of dogs to find dead bodies is kind of amazing. They can sniff out bodies that you think would be very well concealed. So this is the part to me that does seem like it's almost not overstated. You recount very interesting cases where dogs have sniffed out bodies that you wouldn't think that by human senses you'd be able to find.
Right. So, you know, a couple quick examples. Andy Redman's one of the founders of the field, and early on, and this was in the early 80s, one of his shepherds was able to detect the odor of decomposing body from underneath several layers of lime and about 4 feet of dirt. And then the husband, who's the perpetrator, put a fresh concrete patio across the top of that. And you think, oh, my God, how could the dog smell down all through all of that? And what happens is that it's not that the dog smelling through dirt. It's just that even in those situations, decomposing body odor was able to escape up through those layers so that the dog's nose could smell it. And then, it's, as you say, it's very faint odor, but a well-trained dog says, that's faint odor, but it's strongest here, right? And that's where it's helpful to for investigators to say, let's start digging here, right? And I think the other example is water. And a well-trained dog working on water, I write about cases where, for instance, you know, a body being found in 230 feet of water, right? A drowning victim. And again, you go, oh, my God, right? The dog's nose is really, like, penetrating down 230 feet. That's, like, 20 stories building tall. But what's happening, again, that body is decomposing very slowly and sending up gases, and in some cases just a little bit of oil, right? And that hits the top of the water, and the dog on a boat, with a boat going back and forth slowly, is able to say, wait a second, there's scent here on top of the water. Let's see if we send down a diver in a 20 by 20 section of this lake, whether we can find something. And I think that's it's a great use of the dog's nose. And it does feel miraculous until you sort of think that bodies are very cooperative in some ways. They really let off quite a bit of scent. And so even in these extreme cases, they let off enough scent that a good dog can tell.
So people have been working with dogs for thousands of years. It's really sort of an old tool. Now, when you look at some of the benefits that dogs still have, they're not trumped by all of our technology. I know that there have been efforts to develop an electronic nose, you know, to detect bombs or to detect drugs or something like that. Still, though, we don't quite understand what makes a dog's nose so effective that it can be duplicated by technology.
Yes, and I think, you know, Steve, the question of where the dog's nose is most useful, there are lots of electronic noses that are used, for instance, in food technology plants, et cetera, where they work just fine. What we found for things like dogs detecting bombs is that combination of a dog with his or her handler plus people on the ground with good intelligence, those combinations can't be trumped by machines that tend to break down, that have their own difficulty with being calibrated, that can be really hard to run. You know, the dog is an enormously, like humans, adaptable, mobile, and kind of willing partner. And let's face it, they're a lot more fun to work with than machines. So I do think that we still, despite every new claim that a machine is going to be able to replace a dog for these purposes, we find that the dog still manages to be one of our better overall options for certain, you know, for certain purposes.
Kat Warren is a professor at North Carolina State University. She is also a cadaver dog handler and the author of What the Dog Knows, Scent Science and the Amazing Ways Dogs Perceive the World. Kat, thanks so much for talking to us this hour.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure, Steve. Thanks for having me on.